From the Firebird Radio Studio, it's the Authors on Fire podcast with nationally syndicated radio host and producer, Pat Rulo.
Welcome to the Authors on Fire podcast, part of Speak Up Talk Radio's many services, home to the International Firebird Book Awards, the Positive Change Podcast Awards, Hall of Fame, and our newest book song, where we create a musical masterpiece to highlight your book. I am Pat Rulo, and today I have a recent Firebird Book Award winner to share with you. He is Stephen C. Pollack, and his collection of poems is called Exits. This book is a debut poetry collection and was awarded first place for poetry, first place for interior design, and first place for a book that feels like a work of art in our 2025 Firebird Book Awards. He is a poet, essayist, eye surgeon, neuro-ophthalmologist, business executive, and inventor. I found this to be extremely fascinating, so I have to share this little tidbit with you. He designed an instrument used to biopsy inaccessible tumors in the brain and behind the eye. So that just gives you a little insight here into this truly talented individual who I'm lucky to have an opportunity to speak with, and I'm interested to find out more. So welcome to the network, Steve.
Thank you so much, Pat. I really appreciate your inviting me here.
Oh, I appreciate your entering your collection of selected poetry, and I'm excited to talk about them today. But before we do, let me just say congratulations on winning the Firebird Book Award.
Thank you. It was truly an honor, and the fact that it was recognized in three different areas made it even more special.
Well, I'm happy that we met. All right, Steve, I want to just start from the title. Let's just start with that. The title Exits, just the word, evokes both departure and transition. And I was wondering, what does the word exit mean to you personally, as a poet, a physician, and a person?
Well, I think you hit on it when you said an exit is a departure. It, in one sense, is an act of leaving. But it can also be a passageway from one place to another. And the title is plural, Exits, because the poems in the collection address really a wide range of endings. They do deal with the transience of our biological selves, our mortality. But there are some poems that talk about other types of endings as well. And so that was the origin of the title.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned in the intro that you've had a highly accomplished career in medicine and in business. You think about neuro-ophthalmology and poetry. How has your background shaped your understanding of perception? Let's just say that, both visually and metaphorically, as you write your poems.
That's an excellent question. I think that my background in medicine may have had a beneficial effect indirectly, in that I had the opportunity to care for a number of patients with serious and or life-threatening diseases, and that can't help but make you more sensitive, if you will, to the fragility of life and to the fact that everyone's life is finite. On the other hand, my career in medicine was so all-consuming, both the 10 years of training and my 17 years as a full-time faculty member at Duke University, that I really couldn't focus at all on poetry. I read very little poetry, and I wrote none during that 27-year interval. So the impetus to write poetry was suppressed by that part of my career. But in my last year at Duke, when I began winding down my activities, the instinct to write poetry began to reassert itself, and I started writing again in 2003.
Wow. When we think of poetry, obviously it could cover all kinds of themes. What inspired you to center your collection around these themes of exits, transient nature, renewal? What led you in that direction?
I think there were actually three factors that led to a focus on mortality. The first was that I was raised without any religious training whatsoever. And so from a very young age, I was really left on my own to ponder things like the, you know, enormity of the universe, time and eternity, and the meaning of existence. I remember being cognizant of what death was, even at age 5. And just as an aside, I also remember not wanting to fall asleep because it really seemed like a rehearsal for death. Mm. And so my lack of religious training was probably the first thing that made me focus on these types of issues. Second one we've talked about, as a physician and as a neuro-ophthalmologist, you know, I encountered many patients who had really serious diseases, and it allowed me to become more empathic, I think, as a person and as a physician. And I retained that even after leaving Duke University. And then the third factor is somewhat personal. Since 1999, I've had to deal with the spinal cord variant of a disease called multiple sclerosis, which most people I think know as MS, and the ramifications of that disease, both for its disabling effects and for life expectancy. So you can imagine that, you know, having to deal with that on a day-to-day basis also sort of focuses one's attention on the limited time span that we have here on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure. Any kind of a health or medical situation, whether it's you or a family member, does put the non-permanence factor of life kind of right in front of you. And it causes you to view life in a bit of a different way as well. So we're talking about death and dying, and one of your poems is titled Leaves, that you wrote for your wife's grandmother. I would love if you would perhaps share that poem with us. But before you do, maybe just give us a little peek into why you wrote it and what moved you to write this for her.
Well, I appreciate that. And I would be delighted to read the poem. By way of background, Leaves is about my wife, Lori's grandmother, who lived in Hawaii, but was born in Japan. And I first met Grandma when Lori and I were on our honeymoon in Hawaii a little more than 30 years ago. And even though our in-person visits were infrequent, Grandma and I became close over the years. I really liked and respected her. And for some reason unknown to me, she really liked me as well. Once or twice, Grandma actually visited us at our house in North Carolina, along with Lori's mom. And Lori and I attended her 88th birthday celebration in Honolulu. But Pat, the nicest part of the story is that after our very first visit, as we were about to leave, I gave Grandma a big hug. It turns out that this was something very new for her. Lori's family members are just not huggers. But from then on, after every visit, Grandma wouldn't leave without getting her goodbye hug. And I wrote the elegy, Leaves, at the time of her passing.
Oh, thank you for that. What a special relationship. Some people were just meant to be family, right?
I think you're right.
Mm-hmm. Alrighty, well, I'd love if you would read that for us.
This poem is entitled Leaves, for Shinayo Matsumoto. At 91, she still liked to arrange things just so, kept her possessions in tidy boxes, some engraved with Asian motifs, dragonflies, exotic birds, and leaves of bamboo. And how she loved her sumo to watch on the Japanese channel Rikishi 10 times her size colliding like forces of nature filled her with a sense of nostalgia and possibility. She was the venerable priestess of tea. In the autumn of her age, faithful to the rituals of a dying art, she distilled from the parched leaves this pure nectar, green as youth. Flowers found perfection in her hands, wrinkled hands with fingers like twigs. Once, perhaps, as she trimmed the leaves, she remembered a time when she was that perfect flower, blooming in her kimono of peach and green. Her family arranged a simple Buddhist ceremony. In late November, the trees were mostly bare, but across the lawn, beyond the small gathering and the somber stones, the leaves all danced in the air.
Oh my, that is so beautiful. And your reading of it is just so poignant. And you know,
Thank
Steve,
you.
as you're reading this, I'm thinking there's so few words there, yet we feel like we know who she is.
I'm glad that you had that response. I was hoping that readers of the poem would react exactly the same way.
You did it. That's just so lovely. I am kind of got a little bit of goosebumps here. I've got to get over that before I can move on. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Oh, so your poems are paired with artwork throughout the book. How did the visual components come together? Did you write the poems first, or did any of the art influence your writing?
Well, the poems were all written first. Most of the poems that appear in Exits were written between, 2003 and 2023. And they were written before the idea of becoming a book author, you know, ever crossed my mind. I only decided to pull together what I consider to be my best works about 3 years ago. And at that time, the book was going to be entitled Line Drawings. But as I went through the process of selecting the poems, I noticed that a significant number of them related to one or more aspects of mortality. And that led me to curate a more concise themed collection, and Exits was born. But at that point, I wasn't thinking about adding artwork. That came later. And the decision to include visual art was an intuitive one. I sensed that many of the poems would resonate in interesting ways with visual images, and that this would enhance the reader's experience. While a few of the images were selected for purely illustrative purposes, for example, the image of the goldfinch on a coneflower that accompanies the poem Seeds, that's almost purely illustrative. But most were chosen because they offered alternative slants on the content of the poem, or complementary perspectives on the poems. So, for example, the poem Eclipse is just dripping with erotic innuendo, but it's paired with the image of a 1908 patent for an orrery. It's a hard word to say, orrery, but it's a mechanical device that replicates the motion of the earth around the sun and the moon around the earth. Another example is the sonnet Nasal Biopsy, which is ostensibly about a surgical procedure, but I selected a cathedral door to accompany the poem because the voice of the poem, the speaker, perceives Gothic architecture in the anatomy of the nose, and also because the poem is ultimately concerned with questions of faith. So to answer your question, the artwork came later, and it's not entirely about illustration. In fact, it's more about adding depth to the meaning of the poems.
Mm-hmm. Definitely complimentary and not in your face and obvious. So, you know, there's some subtlety to that as well.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, this collection also resonates with some of today's global anxieties, climate change, pandemics, war. Did these more contemporary issues shape the writing of your book, or did they simply affirm the theme that you were already exploring?
I think the latter, and that's, I say that because although climate disasters have been happening with greater frequency over the last two decades, they've been much more in the public eye recently. The pandemic that we experienced was in 2020, which was after most of the poems had been written. And so I think it was more serendipity that the content of Exits seems to sort of reflect the current zeitgeist and a lot of the angst and anxiety that people have about the state of the world today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This kind of ties into another piece that you wrote, Steve's Balloons. It doesn't directly, as you say, touch on mortality, but it does describe the demise of someone's hopes and dreams, which kind of ties in with the global anxieties that we're witnessing today. Maybe give us a peek into that, and then if you would share that poem with us.
Oh, I'd be delighted to. Steve's Balloons is a poem that's based on something that I saw while I was driving through an economically depressed area of North Carolina. The scene told an entire story. I mean, I looked for 1 second and I understood everything that had happened. And it was a story that was so sad that it almost brought me to tears. I even went home, got my camera, came back, and took a picture. And that picture actually appears adjacent to the poem in the book. instead of me telling you what the story is, I think the poem probably covers the narrative better than I could in prose. And so I'll do what you suggest and go ahead and read it, if that's all right.
That is beautiful. Thank you.
This poem is entitled Steve's Balloons. In our dreams, dreams are like balloons, light and round and always, always rising. As I drove through Haw River, a one church town in the south, I caught a glimpse of their maker and stopped to reflect. The store was boarded up, its gravel parking lot weedy and empty of cars, and I saw where plastic letters had been taken down from the faded roof, leaving a less faded stencil of the words, Steve's Balloons. He must have grown up here, this namesake of mine, amid these rural ruins, the porches in disrepair, the cracked pavement and telephone poles, and the strip mall the locals regard as their special version of Eden. I imagine the boyish optimism that inflated his hopes and buoyed his faith that a worn and weary town would find perpetual cause to celebrate. I saw then that balloons are not at all round, but are shaped like tears, that a dream is not so much that scrap of rubber on the ground as the breath that once filled it.
Wow. I love those last lines, that a dream is not so much that scrap of rubber on the ground as the breath that once filled it. Wow.
When I look at reviews, particularly individual reviews of the book, that last stanza is quoted more often than any other.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you can imagine that seeing this boarded up store and seeing it in the area where it was situated, you know, it should have been obvious that, you know, it wouldn't survive. But I couldn't help feeling an immediate connection because our names were the same.
Mm-hmm.
The actual name wasn't Steve's Balloons. It was Balloons by Steve on the roof. But there was that immediate connection, and it just moved me in a very potent way. I just imagined a young man who just wanted to make everybody happy and open a party supply store and, but it was so naive to do so. And, you know, any business person would have said, oh no, don't do that. And they must have put all their, as you said, hopes and dreams, and maybe even their life savings into opening this store that from the beginning had no chance of being successful. And to me, that was just very sad.
Yes. Yes. That photo that you took, and I'm glad you went back to get that. This is that photo is almost something you can't not do something with it. I mean, even if you didn't write about it, I think it would stay with you. It's such a contrast of the photograph and what was. And I think that just begs you to stop and think about it. And as you're saying, they were doomed to fail from the beginning. But what we don't know is that maybe those years or months or however long Balloons by Steve was there, who knows the joy that it might have brought Steve, his family, or the people who shopped there. So I imagine there were some really happy times surrounding that, even though this picture is quite desolate.
Boy, I hope you're right. I haven't thought of it in that positive light, but you're right. Maybe it did stay open for a time, and maybe the people in the community were better off because of it, and the owner, mm-hmm. you know, may have taken pride and joy in running the shop for however long it did last. So
yeah.
I'm glad you suggested an alternative scenario. That makes me feel better.
I'm getting that feeling. I don't know why. Just looking at this picture, I think Steve was pleased with what he accomplished. So let's hope so. How's that?
Yes. I'll go with that.
Well, you know what? That's the beauty of this book. It's not one-dimensional. I mean, everybody who reads it can interpret it and think in different directions. And so that's a gift, to allow the reader to form their own thoughts and opinions.
It's true. And, you know, people always ask me, well, do you write for, you know, what audience do you write for? And I always respond that I'm the only audience mm-hmm. that I write for initially. For me and for this facsimile of me that is always looking over my shoulder while I'm writing and critiquing every word and making sure that everything that I retain has earned its place on the page, the word ecstasy comes to mind. It sort of captures the feeling that I have when a line comes together, but it also derives from the Greek ekstasis, which is to stand outside of oneself. And that's kind of what I do when I'm focused on writing and completely absorbed in it. So I'm the primary audience, but you're absolutely correct. People have they don't always know what it is that my intent was, and I'm not sure that that's that important. Mm-hmm. What's more important is that they take something away from the poems that they enjoy or find interesting or find illuminating. And that interpretation may be somewhat different than what my intent originally was. And I think that's just fine. Mm-hmm. I think it's true of a lot of poetry. There's a great deal of room for reader interpretation.
Yes, I feel that. I'm wondering, as you move forward, are you going to continue to explore these themes, or are there new poetic territories that you're looking to venture into?
Great question. I don't deliberately write about a particular topic. As I said, it was really fortuitous to find that when I was selecting poems for what was going to be the first book, that I just happened to notice that, you know, such a large percentage were related to life's transience. But I should also mention that I'm very undisciplined when it comes to writing. So I can't sit down every day at my desk and just call forth ideas the way many poets can. I can't use a poetry prompt, for example, mm-hmm. and then dash off a poem. To use a cliche, which poets should not do, I kind of wait for inspirational lightning to strike. Mm-hmm. And so I never know when the next poem is going to materialize, but I never choose the topic before the poem. The poem takes shape, usually beginning as a vague impulse to write in some particular area or about some dream that I may have had or personal experience, or sometimes just an observation in nature that seems to have metaphorical value. Those will prompt a poem. But I definitely don't have a specific topic or range of topics in mind.
Well, then we will just keep an eye on you and see what you come up with. How's that?
That sounds great.
As we begin to wrap up, Steve, are we missing anything that you wanted to highlight today?
Well, I wanted to mention one thing, and that is that many authors have an author website. Mm-hmm. I do not have an author website, but one of the best things that I did with respect to this book is create a book website. And I wondered if your listeners might be interested in knowing how to access that.
Absolutely. That was my next question, was to have you lead us to whatever place and space where we could find out more and get a copy of your book, Exits.
Well, it's the book itself is available in print on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and bookshop.org. And the ebook is also available on Amazon and on most other platforms. But the website of the book is exitspoetry.net. And it's a little tricky because it's plural, exitspoetry. There's no period, so it's like one word. And it's .net for a poetic reason. It's because of the internal rhyming. Exitspoetry.net. So that's why I chose the domain.
Nothing's at random here. Exitspoetry.net. Oh my, thank you for sharing your book with us. Thank you for reading a couple of these beautiful poems. Your writing just captures the beauty and the frailty of life. And so I highly encourage everyone to get a copy of this book. It's just lovely. Exits, Selected Poems by author Stephen C. Pollack. The website, exitspoetry.net. Steve, you are a gift yourself, just these little gems that you've delivered in this book. But just speaking with you today, I feel like I've just received a gift. So thank you. Thank you for spending time with me today.
Pat, this has been so enjoyable. And thank you again for inviting me. I really do appreciate it. Thank you.